Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hi, and welcome to Self-Improvement Atlas, the Personal Science Insights podcast produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We are champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I'm Marie Stella, your host from Melbourne, Australia. Let's start the show. Welcome back to the show. Some of us hope for a mundane job that will allow us to fund our side projects, and others long for a purposeful career. Both routes can be really fulfilling, but one thing's for sure, finding meaningful work might not be the smoothest sailing of journeys. So today we're picking the brain of speaker and writer Rebecca Thiel to learn more about the psychology and design thinking required for a fulfilling career. Hi, Rebecca. Lovely having you on the show. How are you going today?
Oh, doing very well. Thanks for having me.
Amazing to hear. So I'm really curious to know, in your line of work, what's the most common problem your clients come to you with?
Absolutely. So the most common problem is a feeling like their work isn't actually fulfilling them and they have no idea what to do about it. So there's this confusion element and this feeling of, I spend my day doing my work and it's just feeling blah, or even worse than that. So I hear all sorts of variations on that theme and all the intro calls I do.
Yeah. And I feel like a lot of us can probably resonate with that on some level at some point in our lives. But before we get further into detail, we'd like to get to know you better. This is Have You Met Rebecca Thiel? So what do you like to do in your spare time?
So in my spare time, one of my favorite things to do is spend time with my kids. I have two children. They're 8 and 12. And that's a really fun age, actually, both of those ages. So my favorite thing to do is hang out with them. We've been doing a lot of board games and crafts lately. So that's my most enjoyable thing. It's nighttime right now. They're probably in there doing that right now. I'm in my office. They're in the house. And I bet they're doing a whole bunch of crafts and board games, making bracelets and things of that nature.
Oh, that's adorable. I used to play with my little brother. He's like 10 years younger than me. So I was like, yeah, big age gap. And I used to, like, when I hang out with him, it kind of be like, oh, what do I do now? Because I can't really, like, talk to you.
Right.
So we do like baking or cooking or something like that. And it's always going to be like educational, which is always fun.
Yes.
And, you know, and little kids always surprise you with what they think or say. Right.
It's so true. It's so true. Yeah. My sister's 10 years older than me. So I had that same age gap. And it is activities bring everybody together across age gaps, I think, in some very real way.
So board games are such a great bonding activity too. What are some board games you like to play with them?
Yeah, well, the favorite right now is Battleship. I don't know if you have that game there.
Yes.
Okay, good. I was like, that may be very American. Yeah. I suddenly realized. And it's not a very peaceful game. But right now, my son absolutely loves it. He finds it really fun to see if he can hide his ships and we can't figure out where they are. So that's been the favorite. There's a few others that we have that are a little more probably not. They're not ones I grew up with. One called Leaps and Ledges. That has been a big hit in the family. And we cycle through so many different ones. Some of them are even from my childhood, and games like Payday and Monopoly. So it's fun to see things that I used to enjoy coming back.
Yeah, Monopoly is a great family game, but like with my family, it tears people apart.
It can do that.
Someone's going to end up crying and it might not be the children.
Absolutely. It's so true. Absolutely. Keeps it interesting.
Do you read any books?
Yes, absolutely. I love books so much so. And I found that over the past number of years, it's moved into a lot more audiobooks because of the fact of having the kids. And and it works great for being able to be on the go and listen to things, for sure.
And, like,
so lots of favorites.
A little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about films?
Yes. Not as many. I've been doing a lot more in the past. You know, the pandemic changed a lot of my habits, I found.
Oh, yeah.
And,
100%.
And I moved into more like shorter pieces of watching things. But I have made it to the movies a number of times the last 4 weeks because my daughter is a big fan of Taylor Swift. So we have gone to the concert movie 3 times. So
I'm a huge fan too.
Oh, okay. So you know.
Yeah, I know. I haven't been because I've been pretty busy lately. I haven't been able to find the time. So I've really got to go because I heard that it's amazing. Like, it's really cinematic and like all the different angles. So I can't really go. I'm definitely going at some point.
Make sure you make a point of it. It is, like I said, we've done it 3 times. So if that counts as a film, I've seen that many times lately. And we didn't make it to the real concert, but we've seen the movie multiple times.
Have you got
and
a
she's
favorite
now
song?
Asking. Oh, my favorite song is, yes, my favorite song by Taylor Swift is not in the concert, though.
But
my favorite's Getaway Car from the Reputation album. Really random one.
Yeah. No, but Getaway Car is such a good one. And it's from one of her like most underrated albums ever. Cause when it first came out, it was absolutely shunned by the general public. But it's such a good album. I think just people weren't ready for it. So before we digress further into Taylor Swift, because I could do this for like the entire 2 hours.
Totally.
Is there a podcast that you listen to?
So my favorite podcast is actually related to what I do, which is the Work Life Podcast by Adam Grant, organizational psychologist. He just does such a great job of making all of these topics about work so accessible and people get people thinking about it. And it was a student when I taught at Bates College here in Maine for a long time, 18 years. A student said to me, "Have you heard this podcast?" And they brought it to me. And then I was like, "Hell, have I not been listening to that?" That was in season 1. They're in season 6 now. So the student brought it to me pretty early. It's wildly
season
popular.
6. That's amazing. So if you had to like sell it to someone, what would you say, like, an elevator pitch?
Absolutely. And this may even be part of their tagline as I'm thinking it, but it's really about making work work for people. So how all of the elements that don't work about work, like one of their more recent ones was about why meetings are awful, you know, and they talk about the psychology behind it. And so common experiences that we have that then it's about breaking down. What's wrong with this situation? Why is this working for people? And here's the psychological elements that underlie it. So it's really engaging and terrific.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I personally love meetings. I love meetings, especially if they're
good
meetings.
They work for you.
Yeah. If they work well, then no one's gonna hate the meeting. Everyone's gonna be like, "I can't wait to go to the meeting."
You don't hear that too often, I have to say. Most of my clients are trying to figure out how to get out of meetings. They're always strategizing how to get out of meetings. So we're going to do that well in America, maybe, because I don't know many people are like, "Yay, a meeting."
This might be good news for me in the sense of like, well, I don't have an issue here and I don't need to be your client. So this might be good news for me.
That's terrific. It's really good news. Really good news.
I think it also kind of depends on the people you work with too, like a little bit.
Absolutely. A lot.
I say a little bit, but a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I find that people are at the heart of it for almost everybody, of whether work is working for them or not, both their managers and their colleagues. And I have people who stay because their colleagues are so wonderful, even if everything else about the job is pretty awful. They'll say, I just love them. Yeah.
Definitely. When I was younger, I swore off like ever working for a startup ever again. But I found like if you're the team that you work with directly is great and makes you feel good, it can kind of offload some of the stress that comes from working in a startup or having bad hire management or anything like that. So
it's so true.
So who do you look up to the most?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there are so many different people, figures, both in my actual life, right? And because I'm a big believer in like, look around you and there's great people right there. So I look up to my parents, of course. But on the more famous side of things, but probably just not uber famous, is Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning. And I just have so much respect for his path and journey. He was in the Holocaust and lost most of his family members and persevered with his old theory that we need meaning in life. And and then went out and like tested that through doing amazing therapy. So that's somebody that I always come back to that I really think about, lived a really rich life, it seems to me.
That sounds like a great and pretty niche role model too.
Yes.
Because like I haven't heard this name.
I imagine. I was like this famous, but it's pretty niche.
Thank you so much for enlightening me on that. Now we'll move on to the interview section. And
great.
The first question that we like to ask our guests is, how do you define personal development?
It's a great question. And it's, as somebody who studied developmental psychology, has been like fascinated by development basically since I was young, I really define personal development as this process of both having some self-reflection and having experiences in the world that we reflect upon that moves us forward in so many ways in our cognitive development and in terms of our social and emotional and spiritual development and physical development as well. And it's really that interplay between us making that space to reflect and us getting ourselves out there, having some new experiences and different experiences to reflect upon. And I believe that's the engine for personal development and that process of moving forward and making change in a variety of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really well thought out, detailed answer. We usually get, which it isn't wrong either, but we usually do get, well, it's anything that allows you growth, or like anything to do with yourself and development, which is totally like, that is absolutely it as well. But the way you described it was like really in detail. So thank you for that. The next question I want to ask you is, what are the main challenges that people face in pursuit of personal development?
There's so many, and many of them are contextual, right? It's if my belief, and when we talk about design thinking as well, you'll see how much this belief comes in. But if there's this loop between reflecting and doing, and they need to feed off of each other, what I find is missing for most of us is the reflecting space. And it's either that we don't have time for it, so it truly is like the context has just pushed it right out of our lives because we're too busy trying to make the money that we need to pay for everything and keep up with all of the information that's flying our way in our phones and on our email. And right. And so reflective space has gotten harder and harder to come by. And I think that's real. But there's also a lack of motivation that even when we do have time, do we really want to be reflecting? Right. So that's a common challenge too. And so I find that a lot of my clients, for instance, have had tons of experiences at work, but have not had the time or the motivation to really make sense of those experiences. And so they're not developing in that area. We can only develop in so far as we're really making the space to be like, what did I learn from this? And what am I going to do about it?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I have actually gone through this thought process before. So there was like a few years where I was only doing freelance work and I wasn't doing any like part-time or full-time or anything like that as I was doing uni. So I had a bit more time to reflect on some of my personal experiences. And whereas some of my friends have had to do part-time work alongside uni or go straight into like full-time work. And then I'll get some of them asking me like, how am I like 4 years older than you? And I like, you're so much wiser than me. And I'm just like, well, I've had a lot more time. I've had a lot more time to think about my experiences and reflect and, like, you know, cut yourself some slack, you know, if you feel like you haven't gotten it figured out, because sometimes the truth is you just haven't had the time. You don't have the luxury of time.
Absolutely. Or don't know how to use the time. You know, I've had clients who will be like, they had plenty of time, but they couldn't structure their thinking and they just spun and spun. That happens to us too.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, it's challenging. It's not easy to do. It's helpful if we have money to things off of whoever that might be.
We all need that, like we all need to kind of verbalize our thoughts and have someone else repeat them back to us. That really helps. And also it's like when you have a second opinion or a third opinion, then you know that you aren't just being biased towards yourself, or like you aren't thinking a certain, you know. And the other thing about not having enough time is even if you do have the time, sometimes you're so stuck in like work. The switch doesn't go like just on and off. Like you can't just switch immediately to like reflective thinking, because sometimes you haven't figured out what reflective thinking even entails.
So absolutely.
You've got to kind of start there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. And even find the right time of day for you. I'm not somebody who's going to be reflective at the end of the day, for instance. I'm a first thing in the morning before I've seen all the emails. But once I've seen all the emails, my brain's only going to be reflecting on what I need to be doing for the emails. And that's not highly reflective at all, right? It's just very task focused.
Yeah.
So often it's also knowing yourself in that way and knowing.
Because it depends. It differs from person to person. I, for example, am a very like nighttime reflector. I like to, I'm able to just like once work is over, I kind of just switch off for like maybe an hour, and then I can reflect after that. But I can't do it in the morning. Like, am I doing it in the morning.
Well, you and I are just complete opposites on that.
Yeah.
Yes. So like, wonderful self-knowledge.
Yeah. Because once I start reflecting in the morning, I can't do anything else but reflect. I can't like switch to work. I don't want to, you know. And then I'm already tired and then I'm like, well, I've got to have a nap now.
Like, you know, that's such a good point.
No morning reflecting for me. So it's a lot about like knowing yourself, and that might take some like trial and error, I reckon. So you might have to try some morning reflecting, fail, and then try some nighttime reflecting and see what, But it can be really daunting to go down, like start with any of this, knowing that at some point you're going to fail.
Absolutely. And it's like, what is the act of reflecting? And, you know, for a lot of my clients, I send them directed journaling prompts, because I'm like, you don't have to just sit and journal openly. That's not comfortable for some people. But are there prompts? Are there things you can think about or take a walk and think about? So it's really a practice, and it's an art form, and it's something that takes time to get good at. Absolutely.
So how would you define meaningful work?
Yes. So there's many different definitions out there, but one of the leading scholars, researchers on meaningful work is a psychologist named Michael Stager, and he, along with colleagues, has come up with a pretty comprehensive definition, which is what I go with. which is that meaningful work is any work that is positive in some way, personally significant. So it matters to you. And that's very, very subjective, right? That it's purposeful in some way. And by that, we mean that it extends beyond the individual. So it matters to me, but it's also about touching somebody beyond me in some way, shape or form, which can be take many different forms and levels. And that it's worthwhile, which is also subjective, right? So those four components are what I think of because of Michael Steger's great research on this around what meaningful work is.
That's really interesting because even with those four components, they can be very subjective. Because for example, you're working just in a regular retail store and like from an objective point of view, that's like, well, you aren't really touching anyone like beyond yourself. But if you think about engaging or employing this attitude where you're like, I want to make random people's lives better and like more fun and just like put a smile on someone's face, that can absolutely be purposeful work.
Exactly right. It's all about your approach to the job, not the job itself. We've all probably run into people who are doing work that is very selfless, but they're doing it in a way that is painful to like witness and be around, you know, you're like, yeah. Oh, this is awful. And then you have people who are doing quote unquote mundane tasks, but they're doing it with such a sense of giving that you're just drawn in by them. And that's what's so key with meaningful work is that it is entirely subjective. It's something that we get to define for ourselves and we can change our response to what we're doing to make it more meaningful. And that's what I love about it. It's not like you have to go find a job that is meaningful. You have to make the job you have more meaningful. And that's fun task, in my opinion, because that's all life is. It's like taking what we've got and crafting it into the best version we can.
And it sounds like it's also not really about going for your dream job or your what you've wanted to do since you were a child. So why is finding meaningful work so important in the context of psychology? How does it affect someone in terms of their personal growth?
Oh, in so many ways. So in one area of psychology is humanistic psychology with this belief that we're all developing and trying to move towards this pinnacle called self-actualization, right? This sense that we are the best version of ourselves. And certainly all of the beliefs around the pursuit of meaning fall into this camp that we believe that, you know, we get meaning when we believe we're getting to a better version of ourselves. And so when people are lacking that, when they're not able to have that sense that they are bettering themselves in the process of living and working, you see all sorts of detrimental outcomes, right? There's a lot of what this languishing is what we would call it. Instead of somebody flourishing in life, they're languishing. They may be free of mental illness. This has nothing to do with mental illness or not. This has to do with the ways in which you can be free of mental illness and be absolutely despondent and right and feel like I don't have that sense of identity development that I feel like I should. I don't feel like I have that sense of purpose and impact. You see the people who are languishing. They're all around us, sadly. They are in a lot of work settings. And it's a state of being fine. But fine is not enough. And so in terms of our understanding of psychology, it truly is about personal development is about continuing to move towards self-actualization. We'll probably never fully get there, but meaningful work is a key way in which we move towards that sense of being more and more self-actualized so that each day feels richer and more full and we experience identity development through the process of each day. And so it's not a nice to have. It's not a that would be so wonderful if I had that, but I don't need it. It's actually, a lot of research shows, quite foundational And one of my favorite studies on this is Gallup did worldwide research and on well-being. And they found that the well-being that is based in career and purpose is the type of well-being that predicts all the four other ones, the ones around our health and our community and our sense of social relationships and our financial well-being as well. So these things mm-hmm. that we talk about that are like often elements of personal development that we focus on, our health and our money and our social relationships, those are predicted by feeling good about our careers and our sense of purpose. That to me, in worldwide research, that blows my mind.
That's really interesting because it sounds like it's also kind of a huge factor that plays a part in whether or not we can stop thinking about, oh, I want to retire every day. Like, you know, like stop waking up with a feeling of like, I can't wait to retire.
It's such a dangerous belief. I mean, because I'm the person who's always saying, you're not guaranteed that retirement, right? And I have plenty of people who either have experienced illness or loss or, you know, that before the retirement stage and they were living for retirement. Mm-hmm. Oh, how disappointing, how difficult. Mm-hmm. And you've got right now, and we get to make the most of this. It's really concerning to me when people are like, it's going to be so much better. Even sadder is that if you look at the data and what happens to people's wellness and well-being in retirement, it's not a beautiful picture. It's beautiful for a period of time called the honeymoon phase. But as a developmentalist, even in my 20s, when I started looking at realities of what it's like, older adults are happier than any other stage of life. So that is true. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But in terms of the retirement experience, it's very mixed. And it tends to be, if a person can't find a sense of purpose in retirement, they languish as well. And you don't have to be doing paid work in order to be needing to work. And so I work with people on the brink of retirement who are planning out their retired life so that we're making sure they're going to have that sense of purpose, because that's absolutely essential. And so we find work for them that is unpaid work. Usually they don't need the pay anymore, but they need to stay engaged in society and feel like what they bring to the world matters and impacts somebody beyond themselves.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. I lived with my grandfather when I was growing up and when, like, through his retirement, and he was so unhappy because, well, I think in maybe the past, I'm not sure if this goes for everyone else, but a lot of us weren't really thinking about how happy or not we were going to be. Everyone just kind of assumed we were gonna be free, like, during retirement. But when my grandfather stopped working, it's like going from a full-time job with a purpose every single day to not having one at all, while everyone else in the household has somewhere to be every single day. It's kind of lonesome. And also at that stage, getting him to come around to, like, making new friends at the community center, at that point, it was way too late. He didn't want to make new friends. It's really important to start thinking about that beforehand. And my father's also thinking about retirement now. He's probably retiring in the next 2 years or so. And he forgot about that completely. And thankfully we do cover retirement on this show.
Good.
So I was like looking up some articles on like psychology today. Great. To like...
Yeah.
He's a very like science-based, math-based person. So I like found articles from psychology today and then I sent them to him and he was like, oh no, now I'm panicking because I don't know what to do because like I've got the money sorted out. I haven't thought of what to do.
Yes.
I love working
with people in that place. Exactly that. It's so fun.
And you've got to also think about like backup options. What if like the first few things that you think about don't actually end up making you feel satisfied. You've got to think about that too. Yeah, but before we digress into like this whole retirement, which is like a totally different, completely, well, it's like kind of related,
it's about work. It's about the end of paid work and then thinking kind of about a work more expansively to me. That's what it is.
It's like a whole realm of on its own with people in completely different mindsets. But I really wanted to ask you, what are some misconceptions people have about pursuing meaningful work?
Oh, so many. And some of them relate to what we were talking about before about the definition, where we were talking about how subjective meaningful work is. So many people think about meaningful work as if it is a type of work, like it is a job. And usually people think about helping professions as being meaningful. They think about high-paying jobs as being the most meaningful. They think about high-status jobs as being the most meaningful. And actually, none of that is accurate. The subjectivity underlies all of this, that yes, helping professions can feel wonderfully meaningful, but they can also feel not at all meaningful to people. Talk to the many teachers, at least in America, we're losing lots of teachers and educators who went into this profession and don't feel meaning in it for a variety of reasons, having to do with structures and burnout. And so that's one example. We're also losing tons of nurses and doctors as well. The healthcare profession is ostensibly so meaningful, but there's lots of people are saying, this doesn't feel that way to me. So, and on the flip side, like you and I were discussing, you've got people in quote unquote lower status jobs, certainly lower paying jobs, who are not directly helping others in their tasks. And they can feel great meaning, not to a one, but again, it's the person who's embodying this and making decisions. And some of the best research on this has been in what's called job crafting, the ways in which we make our existing job better for ourselves in terms of the ways we think about it, how we relate to people, the tasks we do. And one of the classic studies on this was custodians in a hospital system and the ways in which, you know, this is not high status work. It is not high paying work. It's not really helping work. They're in a hospital, but they're cleaning things, not helping the people. And the researchers found that the custodians that reframed this work as a way of helping others, so they would interact with people walking down the hall, they'd make jokes with family members who were waiting for their loved ones who were in surgery. They would find ways even in the rooms to make it feel more meaningful to them, that as they were cleaning, they would move pictures around to try to be stimulating to the patient, even if the patient was comatose, because they just felt like, well, it's changing their environment. These are not in their job description, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that study, you just go, the examples are incredible.
Yeah,
and you're able to see.
The unsung heroes.
Yes. And not everybody approached it that way. There were custodians who were like, I mop the floors, I take out the trash, right? Like, and their work didn't feel meaningful. They were doing their job. They were doing it well. But so the misconception is that you can call up a career coach and say, find meaningful work for me, because as if it's like a label on a job. Or they're like, okay, I have to go do a nonprofit work to be meaningful. Says who? Says what? What? So that's the biggest set of misconceptions hangs together around that, and that meaningful work is a cherry on top rather than absolutely essential for our well-being.
Yeah. It's really more about your approach to it. And it really reminds me, the example that you shared with me really reminds me of my partner who he spent 5 years working retail in this huge stationery supply. I don't know what to call it. It's a stationery supply chain store. It's a major stationery retailer, I think is the best way I can put it. It's called Office Works, where they have like office supplies and like printers and stuff like that. Huge one in Australia. And he, every day he went to work going like, oh yes, I can help you with that. I know exactly what printer will be good for you. I know exactly what weight of paper this is.
And then he makes kind of like a game out of all of these things. And it was like his favorite job ever that he ever held down. And like, that's amazing to me because like,
yes,
you make paper and printers fun.
Totally.
Like, how great is that? Yeah. And always like managing it, help out the customers, like, and creating mini games out of it. Just amazing.
Absolutely. It's a great example. And he probably had some autonomy and he felt some sense of mastery. And those are the elements that often underlie that sense of like, now I can take the tasks and make them more meaningful for me because the environment is good enough to support me in doing that. Absolutely.
In a stationery shop.
Yes, exactly. And there are environments that are high status, high pay that don't offer autonomy and they don't offer the chance to feel any mastery. And so they just wring the meaning right out of the experience, which is fascinating to think about how that can play out.
Yeah. So tell me about design thinking. What is it?
Oh, and it's so, I've been already alluding to it many, many times in our conversation. So now to talk and put actual words around it is exciting. So design thinking is a way of approaching our building anything around us, our life, our work, our products, whatever you want to. That is very much about a recurring loop and iteration and being able to start in that reflective process and be able to test and then make changes. And so the design thinking process is really about knowing yourself, moving into brainstorming possibilities, actually testing rather than just jumping in and doing things, and then learning from those tests what you may want to actually dig deeper into. So there's lots we can unpack there to the extent you want to.
So how does this mindset help in shaping a meaningful career? At what point does someone have to employ this kind of thinking, and how would it help them with meaningful work?
Yes. So to me, it is my essential process for the meaningful work process. Many practitioners, coaches would do it different ways. But to me, this is all about meaningful work is finding that nice blend of knowing yourself and your values, your personality, your preferred skills, your growth skills, your desired impact and purpose, understanding those well enough to think about the many ways you might work in this world. And that could be in big ways in terms of job titles, or it could be within my existing job. How could I do this job slightly differently that would be more in alignment with what I know of myself? So brainstorming possibilities for either side, like a job change, a career change, or a job craft within our existing work. And then instead of just diving in and saying, yes, great, I'm going to go and change my career completely, prototyping or piloting that with the smallest use of our time, money, and energy, being able to test out, oh, would this idea be a good idea? Let's see how this feels. Let's collect that data and then make the changes. So in terms of meaningful work, it really is essential to the process, because the more you can align what you're doing with who you are, the more personally significant it's going to feel. And if you're baking in the purpose piece, that piece of impact beyond yourself, then you're hitting the key components of meaningful work. So that to me is how I move people forward, whether they want to stay in their existing job or whether they want to stay within that job title, but move organizations or make a much bigger career pivot. We use this process to actually very systematically move forward and through it.
And what would you say are some of the challenges when it comes to trying to employ this mindset?
Yes, a great question. So there's different challenges for each person. And I always say to everybody, there's going to be a stage that feels horribly uncomfortable to you. So some people are really uncomfortable in the very beginning, that reflective piece that we talked about. So knowing their own values and I'll have clients who say to me, how would I know that it's what I really believe or that I really care about this? And me as an introvert who's always kind of known that about myself, I always find that an interesting question. So I have some people who struggle there. So we work through that. Others struggle with the prototyping process, that they are someone who would naturally just jump right in. They get an idea and they want to run with it. So they're like, hey, maybe I do want to be a fashion designer. I'm just going to go for it. Woo, hold up, because that's a big commitment that you're about to make. You're about to change in all of these ways. Or I have a lot of clients who are like, I'll just go to school. I'm going to go back to school. That's a lot of time, money, and energy you're going to put in. Let's make sure. I had one client who said to me, I think I want to go get an advanced degree in psychology. And I said, okay, based on what? You know, that you took a lot of classes before. Oh, no, I haven't taken any classes in psychology, they said, but it sounds great. It's like, well, you know what? Let's start with find a low-cost class. Prototype it by taking some low-cost or no-cost class online. Experience that. Collect some data from that. And then we ease into bigger commitments, more pay, more, right? A certificate program maybe. And they only did the low-cost class and came back and was like, that was really interesting, but it's not for me. I was like, well, we saved you many years and tons of money. So some struggle with leaping too fast. And the other key piece about prototyping is you've got to talk to people. We learn the most from having conversations. If I want to know about a job I'm not doing, I could research it online. But the best way to really understand a job I'm not doing is to talk to somebody who does that job, right? So that classic informational interviewing for truly information. And I have a lot of clients who struggle there. They don't want to reach out. They feel bad asking for help. They feel awkward. There's social challenges around it, right? And so that's a very common point of us working through it. And what I don't do is say, okay, you don't have to talk to anybody, because even as an introvert, I need to be really comfortable reaching out to people. That's a growth point that I've worked on, a key piece of my personal development. And I know how essential it is for people in society to be able to do that. So it's a skill set that we work on.
Yeah. I feel like I personally struggle with the prototyping and reaching out to people for sure, especially if they're people that I don't normally talk to. They're not in like my circles. They're just like an acquaintance or an acquaintance of an acquaintance. It's really hard to get that running. And with the prototyping, I struggle with every single time I find something that interests me, I like a hobby or something like that. It's a little spark in me, and I've got to spend hundreds on it. I've got to, and I keep thinking, this is what I'm going to do. This is it.
Right.
This is what I'm going to do.
Right. You go too far, too fast.
And
yes.
It never ends up being the thing that I'm going to do for the rest of my life. Never.
Exactly.
But yep. For some
I'm
reason,
always the person saying, slow down. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's very common. I mean, that's cognitive foreclosure. We have a natural tendency as humans to foreclose on ideas. Like, we do not like that state of ambiguity. And then not being certain, very uncomfortable. Yeah. And so foreclosure, where you're like, I have an answer, but it might not be the real answer. That's why we call it foreclosure and not like true identity achievement, where you've actually gone through the struggle and come out on the other side and said, oh, yes, this is truly it. It's so much more comfortable to have foreclosed on an answer than to sit with the, well, I have five different possibilities. And my job as a coach is to keep bringing people back to the discomfort for a bit longer, because by moving through that, they're going to have a much more successful outcome than letting them just, okay, like you said, this is it. Here it is. I'm running. So
there's also like these, there's also this weird, incessant need to strive for perfection in every single thing that you aim to do. And that's really annoying, because with prototyping, the idea is like you try it out a little bit, but then with this like perfection, this need for perfectionism, you're like, I've got to go the whole freaking way. I've got to like buy all these different types of flour now. I've got to get like industrial baking equipment, that kind of thing. So, yeah. Yeah. Amazing. That sounds like something I definitely need to employ. Thank you so much for teaching me about that. The last question I want to ask you, because we've been talking for ages, it's really easy to talk to you. but the last question I want to ask you is, what are some key takeaways or pieces of advice that you like to leave our listeners with regarding meaningful work?
Absolutely. So pulling out some of the things we've talked about and using them as takeaways, one is that meaningful work doesn't have to be a whole cloth change. You can start engaging in more meaningful work tomorrow or in 10 minutes just by changing your approach. And often the easiest change to make is in how we relate to others. It is the one that is close at hand. Even if you don't interact with anybody, that's a customer or a client, you've got coworkers, you've got somebody that you're relating to, and just changing the way you respond to them. I had somebody today who helps me with health insurance, and she said, "I love talking to you." She's like, "It's just such a joy to have time with you." And I was like, and we're talking about health insurance, not a fun topic in America, to be clear. Very, very stressful. All the premiums are going up about 20% next year. So the stress level is through the roof. Yeah. So we're talking, and she said that to me, and I was like, because even though we're talking about something difficult, why not have a really good exchange about it? I'm going to enjoy it more. She's going to enjoy it more. Mm-hmm. And so make small changes. Get out of your head and do things is the other takeaway, I would say, that we can often either loop in reflection and do nothing about it, or we can go the other extreme and just do and not reflect. And so you've got to make that balance and make sure, I picture it as a loop. And I'm like, okay, if I've been doing a lot and I haven't been reflecting, I know what I need to do. Or if I'm spinning the wheels in my head, I need to figure out what's the next step that I take to test or to move forward or get some data. So those are my two big takeaways, is like small changes and make sure you're doing the reflect, do process in a very balanced way. That's an iterative loop.
Thank you so much for that. That was really aptly put. Now we're moving on to the open mic section, and this is your chance to talk about anything that you're passionate about. And it doesn't have to be related to the topic whatsoever. So the floor is yours. Take it away.
Oh my goodness, that's dangerous. You can probably already tell that I'm actually really passionate about meaningful work and that topic. But the thing that gets me talking for a long time, so I won't talk for long, is I'm just very passionate about the ways in which we support holistic development of people. And a lot of that centers on what we do with our children and the ways in which we are giving them space to become who they're meant to be rather than molding them into who we want them to be in a variety of ways. And that's whether that's parents or society. So I get very riled up about the ways in which we, and it may be different in Australia. In America, we've created a system that is an educational system that is very much about putting kids in boxes and not about this design thinking approach where we start with who they are and let them test and iterate. And we've become more so over time. So I get really, really, really passionate about thinking about the ways in which I wish we could make changes, the ways in which I, in my small sphere of influence, which is my own two kids, the ways I'm trying to help them unbox so they can lean into this more playful approach of exploring and starting with who they are and not who they're supposed to be. Because the reality is, when I work with my coaching clients, so many of them are working through, as 30-somethings, 40-somethings, 50-somethings, they're working through this experience of having been told they were supposed to be something or feeling they were supposed to be something, right? And and they are trying to come out from that and be like, can I be this other thing? I think I'm really this other thing. Is that okay? And a lot of our coaching sessions are about letting them ease into a sense of themselves that they haven't been allowed to live into. And a lot of that is based around status and income and, you know, you're supposed to look this certain way. So my passion for the early years and the ways we do the educational process, including in college where I taught for a long time, really stems from spending a lot of time with people in midlife who didn't get to do that and are struggling.
Yeah. I've got to say, that's such an amazing cause. And that really resonates with me. I didn't grow up in Australia. I grew up in Singapore. So I have no idea what I have some idea what the education system is like. I just don't feel like I'm in the place to comment on it. But where I grew up, I think it's also like probably with my mom or like my parents, thinking that I was going to be a certain way. I was made to play the piano at 3 years old. I was sent for piano classes that I didn't really want to go to. And I really wanted to play the guitar when I was a lot younger. I just didn't get to until like I was 12 or 13 or something. After I worn my mom down for a few years, then I was allowed to. Yeah. But the idea is like we are also put in boxes, I feel like, in the Singapore education system from a very, very young age. I think like 14 or something, we're sent into different streaming like classes where like, well, if you've got good grades for like certain subjects, you take like three different sciences. And if you don't do so well in the sciences, you take the humanities classes. And that's very much like putting kids into boxes. And yeah, that's so I can really resonate with that. And your cause is great. I hope that you get it out there and you spread that because that's amazing. And thank you once again for joining us today. If our listeners want to find out more about you, where can they go?
Absolutely. So the best place is to go to my own website. I make it simple. It's Rebecca, F as in Frank, T as in Tom.com. So RebeccaFT.com. And that's the best place. I also write for Forbes. So I have a website on Forbes as well. And I love LinkedIn. So it's the only platform that I really love. So feel free to come over there and shoot me a note, connect with me. I'm really happy to engage with people on LinkedIn. It's just a wonderful platform for that.
Beautiful. RebeccaFT.com.
Yes.
We'll link that and the rest of the stuff in the show notes. Thank you everyone for tuning in and we'll see you in the next episode.
You've been listening to the Self-Improvement Atlas, the Personal Science Insights podcast produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. For more episodes like these from 10 different life management perspectives, search LMSL on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you can get updated on everything we have to offer. We have a wide range of topics readily available for you to check out. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating our show, sharing it, and subscribing to our channel as it helps us grow and bring you more quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website at pe.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Marie Stella. Thanks for tuning in.